From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Supreme Court on Monday decided in a historic 6-3 ruling that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1967 applies to LGBTQ workers. In what was hailed as a major victory for civil rights, six justices, including Trump appointee Neil Gorsuch, voted to apply the landmark civil rights law to the community that has long been left out. Justices Samuel Alito, Brett Kavanaugh, and Clarence Thomas dissented. Explaining the ruling, Gorsuch said an employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex. Sex plays a necessary and undisguisable role in the decision, exactly what Title VII forbids. Justice Samuel Alito denounced the majority ruling, saying it was, quote, preposterous. He added, even as understood today, the concept of discrimination because of sex is different from discrimination because of sexual orientation or gender identity. The ruling comes just days after Donald Trump's administration formally rescinded the gender identity anti-discrimination aspect of the Affordable Care Act. My guest is Imara Jones, a journalist, intersectional news producer, and founder and creator of Translash, a cross-platform journalism and storytelling project which centers the stories and humanity of trans people, especially trans people of color, at a time of social backlash. She's also a Soros Equality Fellow. Welcome to the program, Imara.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this Supreme Court decision came a day after an incredible historic march in Brooklyn that was celebrating the humanity, the lives of transgender people, especially Black transgender lives. It was Transgender Lives Matter March, 15,000 people showing up in Brooklyn. Then you had the Supreme Court decision. So it's been a busy couple of days for you. How historic and important is what the Supreme Court did?
Yeah, I think, you know, we had two types of history occurring. We had one in the Supreme Court where Amy Stevens, who unfortunately passed before she could realize the impact and the history-making role that she would play, passed before she could realize that. But she still was the first trans person to ever be a plaintiff before the United States Supreme Court.
Wow.
And not only is she the first plaintiff, but she is a person that won her case. And the employment discrimination case that was ruled is so important because it just opens the door to the possibility of trans people securing and advancing so many other legal rights that we currently don't enjoy and possibly are tenuous. The second thing that happened that was historic, of course, was, as you mentioned, the march. It clearly is the largest march for Black trans lives ever. I think it's probably arguably the largest march for trans people in the history of the United States. And they both occurred back to back. And they represent kind of this twin strategy of the way in which rights have always been gained in the United States, which is people power and also working the corridors of power coming together to advance trans rights. We have a long way to go. Trans people continue to be the most marginalized of the marginalized, but these two events coming during Pride Month are very powerful, and their historic importance, I think, is hard to underestimate.
So with Neil Gorsuch taking a leadership role on the court, I think this surprised many. The quote that I read out, I thought was, you know, something that Sonia Sotomayor could have written or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, saying that that an employee who fires an individual for being gay, for being transgender, is the same sort of discrimination as if somebody who was a straight woman being fired because she's a woman. And it's so interesting to see that that comes from Neil Gorsuch. And of course, not surprising that Alito, Thomas, and Kavanaugh ruled the other way.
Well, I think as Trace Strangio argues, who is the deputy director of the transgender program at ACLU, and actually Amy Stevens' lawyer, talks about the fact that a part of their legal strategy was to target Gorsuch. They understand and understood that Gorsuch is a strict textualist, meaning that he very much turns on the definition of the words that are actually written in the law, does not believe in intent, does not believe in extrapolating what people meant or expanding definitions to groups not intended. He very much said that trans people fall under the definition of sex, as you mentioned, and therefore the protections apply to us. But I think we should make sure to understand that targeting Gorsuch was always the goal of the legal team, and it seems as if they made their argument successfully to him.
Meanwhile, Alito tried to distinguish between sex and gender identity or sexual orientation, which, interestingly enough, ended up being a minority position on the court.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, the argument in Gorsuch's ruling was pretty straightforward. You know, if Amy Stevens had continued to live her life as the gender that she had been assigned at birth, she wouldn't have been fired. The only reason why she was fired is because she transitioned into womanhood and they fired her. That's sex discrimination. And also the really good example that he uses the same about, the mythical employer that hires two people, one being man, one being woman. They're both attracted to women. It's just that one who is attracted to the same sex is fired. And that's sex discrimination because you're treating the man and the woman different, even though they have the same attraction. And so I think the reason why it was such a sweeping decision at 6-3 was because the logic, even though on a personal level it may have made the justices uncomfortable, they understood that the logic in the law and the power of the words was just too strong to argue against and to deny. And that really is a credit to the strategy of the legal team understanding who they were arguing before and what they needed to do in order to have a successful result.
Meanwhile, just days earlier, President Trump formally rescinded the anti-discrimination aspect of the Affordable Care Act, which was a very important part of Obamacare, protecting transgender people from discrimination in healthcare. And some are saying quite clearly the Supreme Court ruling undercuts that Trump attempt to overturn transgender rights. So in a way, the Trump appointee Gorsuch didn't give Trump the victory he was hoping for.
That's right. I mean, clearly they were disappointed. And if you read any of the right-wing media, to them, the ruling that took place is Armageddon. But I think that we have to keep in mind that we still have a long way to go.
Yeah.
That the Trump administration may still pursue these administrative moves that they've done across the board, not only in healthcare, but also in education, also in the military, also in housing. And that even though functionally they may be null and void in terms of ultimately passing the standard with regards to the law and the Constitution, the Trump administration may still pursue them and may still, as a result, cause harm as they've done with the transgender military ban. So we have to understand that there's still a long way to go. It wasn't a sweeping decision. It didn't say this applies to all laws everywhere. It lays the groundwork for these additional rules and regulations and administrative actions to be overturned, but we're not there yet.
Let's go back to what took place on Sunday in Brooklyn and what it represents, because the Supreme Court decision comes at the same time that there is this massive national dialogue around racist police violence. And we had this huge march coming at a time when there have been other huge marches that have affirmed unequivocally Black Lives Matter. It's now become a mainstream rallying cry after the police killings of several Black men in particular, but also women like Breonna Taylor. Became very high profile. So you see this very powerful intersectionality on display in Brooklyn, but we haven't seen as much attention to the killings of transgender women, in particular transgender women of color and transgender Black women, right?
Yeah, I mean, this underscores the point that I'm making, that we have a long way to go. So we have a long way to go on the law still, and we have a long, long way to go in terms of culture, We know that the murder of trans women, fueled overwhelmingly by the murder of Black trans women, is such an epidemic that it was declared by the American Medical Association to be such. Those are their words, not mine. And we also know that the United States has the largest number of killings of trans people than any other country on the planet except for Brazil and Mexico. And that's largely fueled by the deaths of Black trans women. And so when it comes to culture, when it comes to society, and when it comes also to state authorities like police, there's a long, long, long way to go. And I think that we can't lose sight of that. We have to rejoice and understand the power of the moment, but realize that this is just the beginning.
How critically important is this moment to bring up the issue of transgender killings in particular? Because there's, of course, a lot of focus on police killings, right? And so I imagine that if I imagine that this is a conversation that can and should be expanded to include all killings, vigilante killings, murders that are clearly based on, you know, hate or the targeting of vulnerable communities, whether they're committed by police or not. For example, Ahmaud Arbery's murder was done by a retired officer, right? There are two killings of Black men being investigated in California that many people suspect and fear were actually lynchings, but it's not clear if police were involved. And yet it's part of the conversation. It feels like our conversation still has space to grow and still needs to grow to include transgender people in particular, transgender women in particular.
Right. I think that there are two things that we need to keep in mind with regard to these murders. I mean, one is that so many of the murders of Black trans women overwhelmingly are committed by Black trans men. And that's a reality. And we need to confront that. And we need to realize that that's connected again to these social and cultural issues that I'm speaking about. But that doesn't mean that trans people don't disproportionately face and are impacted by state-sponsored violence, which is through the police. And that happens not only through murders of Tony McDade, who is a Black trans man who was killed by police under circumstances which remain unclear due to the fact that police have kept them unclear by not releasing several details, but it's also the case that Black trans women in particular, but people overall, are jailed disproportionately under suspicion of sex work. So for example, if a police officer finds two condoms on you in New York City, they can arrest you under suspicion of sex work. There are laws, walking around trans laws in New York and across the country, which disproportionately target trans people and can lead to other types of deaths, such as that of Ling Ling Polanco, who is a trans woman in New York who died in Rikers last year, also under circumstances in which they're probably and overwhelmingly appear to be police negligence. So there's these twin engines of violence against trans people that can lead to death, but overwhelmingly are brutal and serious obstacles, both in terms of this cultural and societal violence and police violence.
Is there a conversation that needs to be happening within the LGBTQ community during, you know, especially this is Pride Month this month, around issues of race? We know historically, for example, the feminist movement had a lot of difficulty dealing with issues of race and also sexual orientation. Are you hoping for some of those critically important conversations to be happening right around now, where so many different issues come clashing? Violence, police violence, racism, transphobia, and in so many of these issues?
Yes. I think, you know, we have an opportunity this year for Pride to return to its roots. Pride started as a police pushback against police brutality by Black and brown trans women disproportionately and people who are gender nonconforming. The police targeted Stonewall because it was known as a place where Black and brown, trans, and gender nonconforming people were, and they thought that it was an easier target than other white clubs in the West Village, and that's how the entire riot started, the 3 days of actual riots, not named riots, but actual riots for 3 days in New York City. And just 4 years later, those people that started the LGBTQ movement were deliberately pushed out of it. And were deliberately pushed out of it by white gay men who felt that the presence of trans and gender nonconforming people in the movement would take away from their ability to secure rights and to be taken seriously. And what we are left with then 50 years later is this unfinished business of the people who started the movement being left out of it. And so in order for us all to actually have rights, though, because what we saw in the Trump administration is because there continue to be these cracks and fissures in the web of rights that are within our community, they began to pick off parts of the community one by one. Started with trans people, but then ramped up eventually to gay people and to lesbians. And so it just underscores that we all go or we don't go. And we therefore do have this opportunity this year to make sure that we expand the focus, that we include the people that were left out and left behind in our conversations about LGBTQ rights, and that we make a massive leap in terms of securing those rights for everybody.
And there's been a debate in recent years around the presence of police at Pride marches, right? I mean, you just gave us a great overview of the history of how the marches began, where police were, of course, the enemy. But in more recent years, police have joined in, and some people have thought that that was just inappropriate.
Well, and then it's led in New York, of course, to the splitting of two marches, right? The place where the Gay Pride March began due to Stonewall split to the Queer Liberation March and to the Pride March last year because of many of these issues. I should say not only because of police, but also a fear of corporatization of the march, these things working together. And there was real tension. I think there's real tension because, you know, as the LGBTQ community writ large begins to diversify or has diversified, it's actually just a fact. Black and brown LGBTQ people have a very different experience with the police than white gay people, to be honest. And so for white gay people, police officers were heroes and all of the things that we now know is associated and cultivated with the way that police police white communities and white people differently than black and brown communities. So you had that play out in our community as well, where white people had one experience with the police and black and brown people had another. And so for many people at these marches, the presence of police was downright uncomfortable because it reminded them on a day of liberation of the just tremendous difficulties that they face in their communities. So I think that that tension was already there. I think right now it is just writ large. You know, we're going to see, I think, different Pride marches as a result. I don't think that Pride going forward, when we can all gather again, they're not going to be the same. They're not going to be, you know, an emphasis on corporations and an emphasis on police because the community has shifted and that's just not going to work anymore.
Imara, where can people find out more about the work that you do?
Oh, you can visit my website, amarajones.com, and you can also go to translash.org and sign up for our newsletter, which is a fantastic way to keep up with me and everything that I'm going to do and am doing and our project is doing. And also just follow us on social media. It's super easy. All the handles are my name. All of the Translash Media handles are Translash Media. So there are lots of ways to keep track of what we're up to.
We'll post links from our website so that people can find out easily about the work you do. Imara, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Imara Jones, founder and creator of Translash, a cross-platform journalism and storytelling project which centers the stories and humanity of trans people, especially trans people of color, at a time of social backlash. She's also a Soros Equality Fellow, and we've been discussing the Supreme Court's decision on expanding civil rights to the LGBTQ community and more. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find out audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.